What's up, people? It's that time again. WGN, let's join the two friends. Jason Whiteside and Rich Lankoff in a legal face-off. Hear the knowledge they got. Legal point and counterpoint, Jay, you know the drill. From sports to Hollywood and the politics world. Not forgetting current events that occur. Plus a couple jabs here and there. Yeah. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. And join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Or send us an email with questions, we hear ya.
Welcome to Legal Face Off. Jason Whiteside, Rich Lankoff sitting in studio. I'm Craig Collins, and for Sam Panionovich, who is covering basketball, which is very exciting for him. But just as exciting as being in here with you guys. Hey, guys, how are you doing?
What's going on, Craig? Good
What's
to
up,
have
Craig?
You on both sides of the mic today. Both sides of the,
double
the glass.
Duty.
Both sides of the glass,
I'm running back and forth. Our first guest is Professor Lori Ringhand. Lori is from the School of Law at the University of Georgia. She's also an author. Supreme Court Confirmation Hearings and Constitutional Change is her book. Lori, welcome to the show.
Hi, I'm glad to be here.
Professor, I'm going to call you Professor, and I'm also going to call you Dean, just to throw you off.
You can take your pick.
He's going to confuse me about who's on the phone then.
You're Associate Dean for Academic Affairs, and you're also the J. Alton, Hosh Professor of Law at UGA School of Law. So we're talking today about Neil Gorsuch. We have covered this issue extensively on our show. And this week, the Senate will maybe take up a vote on his confirmation. Mitch McConnell on the Sunday shows yesterday said that one way or the other, the Senate will vote by no later than Friday on his nomination. Of course, the big issue is whether he will get the 60 votes necessary to overcome a Democrat filibuster. But the question that we have for you and the subject of your recent Washington Post article with your co-author, Paul Collins, is whether it makes sense anymore in this day and age to have lifetime appointments for Supreme Court justices, or whether, as your column mentions, whether we should limit it to 18-year terms. Where do you come down, Professor, on this issue?
Yeah, I would love to see us look at moving to 18-year staggered terms. The United States is pretty unique among constitutional democracies in the world in having a system like ours where you have a political appointments process coupled with life tenure. And that's partially a function of our Constitution being very old. I mean, justices are just serving a lot longer than I suspect was anticipated when that structure was designed.
So one of the – you touched on, you know, one of the reasons that we are unique among most democracies in having lifetime tenure, and you touched on one of the advantages of that, that being justices in our country are free from the influence of politics, allowing them to concentrate on what they're really on the bench for, which is upholding their constitutional obligations without considering politics. That's the idea. Number one, is that really happening? Are justices today, even though they're appointed for life, are they, are they really not allowing politics to influence their decisions, or does that creep into things sometimes?
Well, the advantage of life tenure is not exactly the perceived advantage of life tenure. It's not exactly about a politicized or depoliticized judiciary. It's about judicial independence in a slightly different way. And I think what the founders were originally going for was to make sure that the sitting justices weren't concerned about a post-court career, right? Like, if you only serve for a few years, your decisions might be influenced by worries or concerns about currying favor with someone who will give you a high-level appointment after you leave the bench. That's more the type of independence that life tenure was designed to protect. The confluence of law and politics, that's baked into our constitutional cake. We have a a Supreme Court appointments process that's political by design. I mean, the Constitution places this process in the hands of two elected entities, the President and the U.S. Senate. They knew full well that at the level of Supreme Court cases, there's going to be some discretion that courts that justices have to exercise when they're deciding these difficult constitutional cases. So life tenure is less about avoiding that and more about concerns that justices with very short time terms would try to curry favor out of regard and concern for what they would do after they left the bench.
How would we even go about implementing these term limits, Professor, especially with as contentious as the political system is today? How would that even be accomplished?
Yeah, well, that's the hard part. So let me talk about the advantages of it before we talk about why it won't ever work. So the advantages of a staggered 18-year term, and this gets at the politicization of the process itself. The advantages of staggered 18-year terms are this. We have a Supreme Court comprised of 9 justices and presidential terms of 4 years. So if you stagger terms and they last for 18 years, once that's fully implemented, what that would mean is that each term a president is elected for, he would get 2 appointments. So the advantage of that is twofold. The first thing is that means that the appointments are going to come at regular, predictable intervals. Because right now, it's this high-stakes game of chance, whether you get an appointment or not. You know, we have all of the legal scholars in the country, you know, trying to game out and figure out, you know, what the next vacancy is going to be, when it's going to happen. 18-year staggered terms would bring consistency to that process and ensure that each president would get 2 appointments per term with a senatorial midterm election in between. Hopefully what that would do, by making it predictable instead of having appointments arise kind of at the just by chance, what that would do is bring down the political temperature a bit, because every side knows that if they win the next election, they're going to get the next 2 appointments. So it could bring down the tension in these hearings.
So we're dealing right now with, you know, Judge Gorsuch embroiled in a very political discussion. The Democrats are saying that they're not going to vote for him, although I think 3 at least have come out in favor of him and said they'll vote for him. But Chuck Schumer has said, you know, the standard is 60 votes, and if you don't get 60 votes, then you should throw out the nomination and bring someone else. Under a 18-year staggered system, would a Senate majority still be able to refuse to act on a nomination or vote down a nominee if they found him or her unacceptable?
They absolutely could. I mean, there would be nothing that would change the Senate's constitutionally dictated advice and consent right. But here's what I think would change. The senatorial incentives would change. Because right now, because these vacancies are these treasures that drop into the lap of a president at unpredictable times, if every side knew that these would be appearing in a regular sequence, I think what we'd see is a lot less political energy being expended on this process. Each side would get its turn, and we'd probably go back to something that would look more like what the filibuster rule was designed to accomplish in the first place, which is as long as a nominee is kind of broadly within the paradigms of U.S. constitutional thought and norms, they would probably get through without much fuss, because there's just not as much incentive if you know that if you win the next election, you're going to get your turn too.
Professor, it obviously really depends on the individual, but and this might be, you know, pure speculation on your part, but I'm sure you've thought about it. At what point does a judge cognitively become less than able to fulfill the requirements of a Supreme Court justiceship? I mean, if you've got a 95-year-old judge who is on the court, are they, you know, is justice really being served? Does that really make much sense? Is there do you have any thoughts about what the right age is for a justice to take retirement?
Well, I think it is very individual, but it also is a problem. And we have had justices who have almost certainly served longer than they should have. And that's a problem both from an individual capacities point. There are very few people who can tell a Supreme Court justice what to do. So it's hard sometimes to convince people that it's time to go when for their own health reasons they should. So that's a real problem. It's also a problem, these very, very long tenures on the court can also be a problem from a kind of soft democratic accountability perspective. And here's what I mean by this. As I said earlier, our appointments process is political by design. It's in the hands of elected officials. And there is a good reason for that. The Supreme Court, over time, does need to be responsive to what Americans think is important in our constitutional norms and constitutional values. That absolutely should not be a short-term thing. But over time, it's okay that the Supreme Court it maintains contact of some sort with where the people are on kind of long-term constitutional issues. When justices serve for a really long time, that connection can be very severed in ways that are unhealthy for democracy. So we saw that a bit in the New Deal era, when the justices who were on the high court had been serving a very long time, and they were just disconnected from where the country was at and what the constitutional norms needed to be for that moment.
Professor, last question. We'll let you go. We thank you for joining us on Legal Faceoff. Give us a number. How many votes does Neil Gorsuch get in the Senate vote later this week or whenever that may take place?
I think that would be a very foolish question to answer. So I am not going to do that.
Fair enough. Thank you so much, Professor Ringhand. You are the J. Alton Hotch. Is that correct? Did I say that right? Did I screw that up?
Professor of Law.
Hoach. Okay, let me do that again. The J. Alton Hoach, Professor of Law at the University of Georgia. And you are a author. You wrote Supreme Court Confirmation Hearings and Constitutional Change. You can go to law.uga.edu to learn more. Thank you so much for joining us on Legal Faceoff.
Don't forget her co-author.
Oh, and her co-author on that book was Paul. Let me scroll down. I know she knows, but I'm not going to ask her. Paul Collins. Collins is a great last name, by the way. So cool.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be here.
All right, talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Faceoff. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He has been selected to the 2012 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2016. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEAK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Their clients enjoy a hand-picked team of attorneys supported by a world-class staff. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
Welcome back to Legal Faceoff. Rich Lenkoff, Jason Whiteside sitting in studio. We will turn our attention to Rahm's emails. And for this conversation, we're going to bring an attorney at Lovie and Lovie, Matthew Topic. Thanks for joining the show.
My pleasure.
Matt, thanks. You're outside general counsel for the Better Government Association. Tell us about the fight to get Rahm's emails released. There was about 2,700 of his private emails released after many say he was trying to conceal them. Tell us about why that was and your involvement in that fight.
Well, after the big news about Hillary Clinton's private email first came out, BGA was interested in seeing whether there were local public officials that were doing the same thing. And so we sent requests to the governor's office, to the mayor's office, to other state agencies to try to get an answer to that question. And the mayor's office took the position that those weren't public records and they didn't even have to tell us whether there were any private accounts being used for public business. So we filed the suit. It was a rather long process. The city fought it pretty hard, but we won sort of the initial phases, and then they came to us and said they wanted to try to resolve it, and that's where we are.
What was their answer as to why they shouldn't release it in the first place? Was there any legal basis? I mean, not that, you know, As lawyers, we always like to have some legal basis, but sometimes, you know, that's not always given. What was the response from the administration to your initial request?
Well, their position was that because the records weren't in the possession of the city of Chicago, then they're not public records of the city of Chicago, and there's no obligation for them to go get them. That doesn't work, though, because the definition of public records in our statute is broader than just what the government possesses. It includes things that are under the government's control, and it includes things that were prepared for, prepared by the government. And our position, which we prevailed on, was if the mayor is writing an email and it relates to his job as the mayor, then he's doing that as an agent for the city of Chicago. And so those are records of the city, even if they're not in the city's possession.
So where were the emails, if not in their possession?
There were two accounts. There was a Gmail account, and then there was a campaign account. And the city story, or the mayor's story, I guess I should say, and I've no reason to say it isn't true, but was that the mayor was using his campaign account for campaign activities so that he wouldn't have to do those things on his city account, which would have been improper. And, you know, the line between politics and government, I guess, sort of got a little gray. That sort of, we could spend an hour talking about the ramifications of that. But that's where they were, was on his campaign account, not his private Gmail account.
Hey, Matt, can you walk us through a couple of maybe the key things that you guys found when you went through all these emails? Anything of importance to BGA?
Yeah, you know, there was no smoking gun. If anybody thought that there was an email that said, boy, we better bury that Laquan McDonald video before my next election, you know, there wasn't any email like that. It's not shocking to me. I mean, the mayor is not a stupid person. What you saw actually in these emails was very little that was really written by him. But what there was like an endless parade of people asking for things, you know, all the way from, you know, David Plouffe, who was actually improperly lobbying on behalf of Uber without registering with the city of Chicago. And there were plenty of other people with similar issues that the ethics board is looking at. You had somebody who wanted a street closed for his daughter's wedding. And you just had a lot of people. It's sort of like there was this super class of connected people who had special access to the mayor through this email account, and they, you know, had no end of ideas and favors that they were asking for.
Matt, a lot of what was released, or some of what was released, was redacted. Tell us about, you know, the law behind that. How can the mayor release the emails, but also redact some portions of it?
Yeah, great question. So the first phase of the case was just over whether these are public records in the first place. And we prevailed in that part of it. The next question after that is, even if they're public records, there are a number of exemptions in the FOIA statute which allow the government to withhold them or redact them anyway. And so the first phase of the case basically got these emails in the same position as every other city email, which is in the possession of the city, in a position to be reviewed and either produced or withheld. So the city went through that process, and then they asserted a few exemptions over several hundred documents. We pushed back on that. They reconsidered on some of the documents, but not all of them. We tried to work it out with the remaining documents. They wouldn't budge, and so we filed a motion to basically reopen the case to address those issues.
And what's an example of an exemption that the redaction would be appropriate for? I mean, is it personal things? Is it privileged materials? I know when we answer discovery, for example, Jason and I do, you know, a lot of personal injury law. You know, we're able to put together a privilege log in which we assert privilege over certain documents, you know, for work product or attorney client. What would be the type of redactions that a judge would uphold in this situation?
Yeah, we have dozens and dozens of different exemptions. Some of them are even extremely obscure, you know, different units of government many people probably have never heard of. One of my favorites is an exemption for the answers to test questions for public schools so that students can't FOIA the answers to test. But more pertinent to the case here, there's an exemption for what's called deliberative process, which says when government officials are expressing opinions during a deliberation about a policy issue, something that they're going to go forward with or not, and they're expressing opinions about that, those are exempt. And the idea is that we want to let public officials have an open conversation, brainstorm, speak freely without worrying that initial thoughts or initial ideas they had won't kind of come back to haunt them. That exemption gets horribly overused, though. It really is limited to deliberations over policy issues. One of the key areas that we're fighting over is the city has tried to assert that exemption over their internal discussions about press strategy, how to talk to the press, what information to give to the press. We think the exemption just plainly doesn't cover that. In fact, that's some of the most important things under FOIA for people to know is is there a difference between what the government is saying publicly and what the government is saying privately. So that's an example. There's many, many other exemptions as well.
All right. And Matt, moving forward as part of this agreement, was there a structure put in place as to the personal emails that will be used by the city in the future, or is it a blanket no use of personal emails now?
It prohibits the use of private email accounts for public business, and if someone receives an email on a private account that relates to public business, then it needs to be forwarded immediately to their city account so that it makes its way into the proper record-keeping systems.
Matt, last question. We'll let you go on Legal Face-Off, and we're going to ask you to be a prognosticator here in a question that has been one that many people have asked, not really an answer to, but if you were involved in the Laquan McDonald release of those videos, you helped force the Chicago PD to release the videos. We all know that Mayor Emanuel won the last election by the slimmest of margins. The video was not released until after the election. If that video is released before the election, are we talking about a Mayor Rahm Emanuel right now?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it would have been a pretty tough battle to overcome because this is among the most egregious things we've ever seen police officer do. So, I will say, he's a very able politician. So, whether he could have made it through, I don't know. There's people with more expertise on that than me, but it certainly wouldn't have helped him.
Attorney Matthew Topic from Lovey & Lovey. You can find their website, LOEVY.com. That's Lovey.com. And then you are also an attorney for the BGA. That's bettergov.org. Thank you again, Matthew.
My pleasure.
Whiteside & Goldberg Limited is a law firm that specializes in representing injured people in all types of accidents. Whether it be an auto accident, a workplace accident, medical malpractice, construction accident, or slip and fall, the attorneys at Whiteside & Goldberg have a combined 30-plus years of legal experience to represent you. We offer a free consultation and have two offices to serve you throughout the Chicagoland area. If you or someone you know have been injured and you have questions regarding your rights, feel free to contact the law firm of Whiteside & Goldberg today for a free consultation. You can call us at 312-334-6875. And for more information, visit our website at wglawgroup.com.
We do not accept rolling down the window and let the wind know that you're here. Well, the night's busted open these two ways.
Welcome back to Legal Face Off. It's time for a regular segment on the show where we talk to the Chicago Lawyer Inside Out authors. We have Tina Martini. She's a DLA Piper partner and the chair of the Chicago Intellectual Property Practice. Welcome to the show, Tina.
Hello, how are you?
We also have David Sussler. David is the Associate General Counsel at National Material LP. Hey, David.
How are you?
We are here to talk about what exactly? Guys, what are we talking about?
Diversifying your skill set is the March 2017 topic, correct?
Correct.
All right. So we usually start with Tina, but I think we'll start this time with David just to mix things up. David, why is having a diverse skill set important as an attorney?
Well, for many reasons. We'll talk about me personally as an in-house attorney who has a very general practice. It's important for me to have a diverse skill set, both substantively and personally. I deal with a broad swath of substantive legal issues, and I'm working with people from the C-suite down to the factory floor. So there's a lot of different personalities involved, and I need to be adept at handling all of those things.
So did you know all of those different parts of your job going in-house? You used to be, like Tina, outside counsel. Now you're inside counsel. You know, the perception I think that we have in the outside counsel world is that in-house has to know a little bit of everything. First question is, did you know much of that going in? If not, how did you learn it? Did you take a course? Did you learn on the job? How do you cover all of the things that come up in the inside counsel world?
No, I did not know everything when I started out. And one of the reasons I like my job is I regularly encounter things I don't know because I've never done them before.
And by the way, you still don't know everything.
Yeah, I still don't know everything. Yes, and there's no one better to tell you that than Tina. But I learn. I study. I go to CLEs. I read. I talk to people. Luckily, at this point, I have 30 years of experience to draw upon. But a lot of times I feel like I'm a brand new lawyer. So I study and I learn.
Well, and Tina and Dave, it seems to me, maybe Tina, this is more appropriate for you, given the firm that you work at, but it seems like we, as attorneys, more specialize. We pick one area, we're kind of plugged into that, and, we're stuck with that. Obviously, based on the article, you guys think it's better if we diversify. Why is that? And how do we make that change because the legal profession seems to be so, close-minded with that?
Well, I think that's a great question. I mean, I would say that when it comes to the bread and butter of the legal practice that I have, which keeps me busy full time, it's definitely intellectual property. And within that specialty, it's primarily, trademarks, copyrights, and unfair competition in related areas. But I think it's always good to expand your knowledge beyond that, if for nothing else, especially being an attorney in private practice, such as ours, where we are responsible for building a practice, and that practice can be both with clients that are within our practice area as well as outside. It's good to have at least a little bit of a working knowledge outside of the area in which you practice so that you're able to issue spot. And so if you have a client who comes to you as their trusted advisor and says, well, I have a question, and it may not be in your practice area, but I would like to pick your brain on something, you're able to at least spot issues and be able to figure out who down the hall would be best equipped to help you solve your client's problem. And then also from a leadership perspective, it's always good to develop skills beyond just legal knowledge skills, but, operations skills, talent management, hiring, those sorts of things are part of the business of a law firm. And if you are able to lead not just client teams, but lead teams of others in your organization that are tasked with getting a certain project done or certain types of work done, that just makes you holistically a better professional.
And how do you teach that to younger associates? With all the pressures of the, being a new attorney, the billable, all that, how do you implement an associate attorney to say, hey, this is important, you need to diversify, even though there's a lot of pressure on your schedule?
That's a great question. I would say that the way that I do it is I really try to be a very hands-on mentor and practice group leader in terms of educating and helping these professionals, these new professionals, to understand that they have to be terrific lawyers first and foremost, but as they're building their careers, it's always good to diversify, because as we progress as a profession, it's all about differentiating yourself and developing these skills beyond being a great lawyer, which, let's face it, there are a lot of great lawyers out there. So you need to develop skills that will help you differentiate yourself from others. And what better way than to get yourself involved with, like, hiring, for example, which is something I did as a young associate. I became involved in our hiring program very early on. And that was one of the ways that I wanted to separate myself from others and to develop leadership skills.
I find myself struggling with this issue frequently. How do you, on the flip side, guard against trying to be too many things to too many people, right? One great way to, get yourself in malpractice hot water is to say yes to everyone and be too diverse. So, David, talk about how you avoid being a jack of too many trades. In your position, you have to be, but in private practice, you don't want to be a jack of too many trades, because then you lose focus on your core practice areas, and also, might be doing things outside of your comfort zone, and, that could lead to making mistakes.
Well, in the in-house context, I am a jack of all trades. I have depth in certain areas, and because of my diversity, I'm good at issue spotting. And when I spot an issue that requires a level of expertise that is beyond me, that's when I go to outside counsel. For example, environmental is one of those areas that's easy to point to. It's such a complex regulatory scheme. I know a little bit, and I'm comfortable in talking to outside employment counsel, so I know if they're on the right track or not, but I'm not going to pretend I'm an environmental lawyer, so I call an environmental lawyer. It's the same in the intellectual property area. I've absorbed a bit of knowledge from Tina over the years, and I've been Tina's client as in the intellectual property area. And so I know enough to spot the issues, and then if I need trademark assistance, for example, I'm going to call Tina. I'm not going to try to register a trademark myself.
Tina, as outside counsel, how do you know when you've stepped out of your comfort zone, it's time to call in someone else?
I know that I've stepped outside of my comfort zone when it's something that I'm not able to figure out pretty quickly. And it's one of those things where you sort of have to go with your gut. And I think as you progress in your career, when you're first starting, you're obviously learning a lot of new things, and pretty much everything is outside of your comfort zone. But you're, you know, working under the tutelage of lawyers who are teaching you a particular practice area. But as you get more senior, it becomes pretty obvious pretty quickly when if it's something that you either don't know right away or don't know how to get the answer to right away. It's one of those things where you really should be talking to somebody down the hall. Now, I know a number of folks who, over the course of their career, for example, were practicing in an area that became outdated because of legislation or there were just practice areas that became very difficult from an economics perspective to have at their firm, and so they diversified into a different area of practice. That is a bit of an exception to what I'm talking about, because in those instances, you know you're learning something new and you're gaining the expertise and knowledge from people down the hall who help you develop that skill set. But if you find that you're not really focusing on the day-to-day knowledge base that you have, then I think it's a pretty good indicator that you're maybe going a bit too far afield from your practice area.
David, last question goes to you.
Can I throw something in here real quick?
Sure.
One of the ways I've often described my practice is I have developed a comfort zone in being outside of my comfort zone. But also, as Tina said, you know, as I've developed along in my practice, part of that is knowing when to call the expert. And that's an important part of your skill set.
All right, David, last question goes to you. You've talked about diversifying your skill set, yet you're one of the least diverse people when it comes to your obsession with Bruce Springsteen. What about diversifying your musical taste a little bit?
I mean, David, you don't have to answer that question because Bruce is a great pick. You don't have to, but go ahead.
Craig's new to the to this segment, so he doesn't realize.
I don't. I have no idea.
Yeah, Craig.
I was just thinking yesterday, as a matter of fact, that I have been a Springsteen junkie for 43 years this year. I also do have a very diverse music taste that Tina just recently purchased a newly released version of her favorite Aha album.
Wait a second. Is there more than one Aha album?
There are quite a few. Oh, and gosh. I got to tell you, that's a really good band, and their lead singer has an awesome voice.
It's the last time we'll ever ask David Seltzer on this show, by the way. That's your final statement ever on Legal Face-Off.
Tina, that was a segue you never expected, isn't it?
Yeah, Tina, you're in addition to being partners with David in the column, you're his wife. What would be the one musical, let's say the one CD, if we still use CDs, about you that would make us the most surprised? What's the most shocking? We've already heard from David's record collection. What's the most surprising? What's the most surprising record of the Tina?
I like it.
Yeah. Do you got any?
Which band are you asking? Yeah. Which band would people be most surprised that I'm into?
Yes.
In a very inarticulate way, that's my question.
Okay, so I'm not sure how shocking this is going to be.
GWAR, maybe Insane Clown Posse,
Wham. How about that?
Okay, so I have to say, and maybe a lot of people will lose respect for me when I actually come out and say this, that one of my Desert Island albums, if I had to so choose, would probably be Cutting Crew. I don't know if you guys
love
remember
that
song,
Died in Your Eyes.
In Your Arms
Tonight. You guys love
that
the 80s.
That is a great, great album. Let me just say, Everybody should go out and buy it. It is everything that made the 80s fantastic.
Was Kyrie them too? Is that
no? That's Mr. Mister, and I'm a Mr. Mister junkie also, as well as the Hooters. Do you notice that this Hooters is like an interesting trend of data points that we've accumulated?
Hooters, A Nervous Night was one of the best albums of the 80s.
You guys have great musical
it's
taste.
Fantastic.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything questionable about any of the decisions either one of you have made. This all makes complete
it's time
sense.
For a Two for Tuesday here on the 80s mix on WGN.
Yeah, we're gonna go out with some of this music then, I think.
Yeah, for sure.
Thank you so much. The Chicago Lawyer Magazine Inside Out columnists. We have David Sussler and Christina Tina Martini. Tina is a partner at DLA Piper. To learn more, go to dlapiper.com. And David is the Associate General Counsel at National Material LP. To get more information about them, I had the website up a second ago. David, what is the website?
NMLP.com.
There we go. I did this professionally. Thank you so much. We'll talk to you guys soon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, see you guys.
Welcome back to Legal Face Off. It's time for the Legal Grab Bag. I'm Craig Collins, still sitting in, because Sam Panianovich is in Arizona. And we all found out about this a day ago.
Moments ago. We got no invite for us for fun.
He's a fancy guy here at the station. They sent him off to do fancy things, so that's why.
Where's the best trip you've ever taken on WGN's time,
Craig? I believe that we went to a Portillo's in the suburbs.
Oh, over Portillo's. On like Dearborn and over Dearborn and whatever.
Correct,
Ohio,
exactly.
Yeah.
I had one of my clients from Texas. He's a Hispanic gentleman, and he saw the Portillo's, and he said, that place looks great. It's like, Portillo's. He was like, Portillo's. I'm like, it's not Portillo's. Portillo's.
Yeah.
Hey.
Yeah. It was out from Maywood, Illinois, or Elmwood Park. That's all. Wrong pronunciation.
Somehow shockingly, though.
By the way, the other day, I did a whole night. I had a couple drinks, and I did a whole night
that's
as Tony Montana. But like, not the traditional, like, hacky impersonation,
sure.
But, like, just what would Tony Montana sound like in everyday life? So, like, would you please pass the pepper? I like to have some pepper on my rice, okay? And then we did a bunch of like songs as Tony Montana. Like,
are you gonna do the whole Legal Grab Bag in that voice? Yeah. I think you should.
First on Trump Watch, we have federal judge approves Trump University settlement, man.
Yeah, that's correct, Tony. The first point of business is our Trump Watch segment. We're talking about this federal judge. Go ahead, guys.
So it's hard to recover.
Can you shift
Tony Montana voice?
Can you shift back to the Jewish attorney,
right?
As opposed to
tried to help.
So
transition.
On Trump Watch today, we've got a couple of points. We've got federal judge late last week approved the $25 million class action against Trump University. Part of the deal is that he can no longer use the word university, probably appropriately so. But, yeah, this was a class action of several former students from Trump University. They paid tuition ranging from $1,500 to $35,000. They expected to be taught secrets from Trump and his instructors. It turns out that most of the information was available free online. So,
yeah, I think the biggest secret was have a dad that's already a millionaire, and then you'd be a billionaire in real estate.
Class over. But the judge approved the settlement. So most of the class members will receive, I think it was like 75% of what they, or actually 90% of what they paid. So good settlement. Remember, Trump in the campaign said he doesn't pay settlements when he's not wrong because he would encourage others. So apparently it's one of many things that the president has changed face on or changed his mind on. Another one being to our second topic, legal immunity on the campaign trail. Trump and Michael Flynn both said that if you ask for immunity,
you're guilty.
So,
but yeah, actually, Flynn did ask for immunity in order for him to testify and about the Russian investigation and probe. So there was a question and answer session about what is legal immunity and who can get it. But originally, Congress can grant the immunity to people so that they can testify without fear of being prosecuted by Congress. So that's what Flynn was seeking to get with the immunity request. But I do believe that was denied. And he's did he already testify?
Well, no, he hasn't. So, yeah, he just asked for it.
He disclosed
his attorneys last week, but they haven't. The Senate just began their hearings last week. It's not been decided whether he's going to be granted immunity yet, but he probably will. And, you know, the big question is whether someone who asks for immunity automatically means that they are guilty of the crime.
No.
Not always, but it's a pretty big red flag, right?
That, if they're asking for immunity, yeah, they're generally trying to hide something and they don't want to be prosecuted for it. But,
right.
And not in all circumstances.
Okay, so now we move on to a story that's been in the news a lot recently. Chicago police made their first arrest in the sex assault shown on Facebook Live. A 14-year-old boy has been arrested as one of the... you guys, explain this to me a little bit better. Was he the one filming, recording? Do we know what his involvement is?
Well, no, I think he was the perpetrator, the one that actually committed the sexual assault. So, you know, there's been a couple stories that have come out regarding Facebook and, you know, Facebook Live and streaming these. Probably a month or so ago, there was the assault and beating of the mentally handicapped individual that we covered. And now there's a 14-year-old boy who sexually assaulted a 15-year-old girl. It was live streamed and watched by about 40 people who just did absolutely nothing, but they were able to arrest the 14-year-old, which creates a couple of different legal issues because, you know, you have a minor now, everything's going to be sealed, but then there's that age which they, you know, do prosecute them as an adult, but I don't think that's 14. Do you know, Rich? I mean, there's no way at 14, I don't believe,
you'd
be prosecuted as an adult.
No, I think it's 16. Yeah, I mean, like you said, you know, continues the trend of people using Facebook to show, broadcast their crimes to the world. This one was particularly gruesome, and thankfully, through some good work by the Chicago PD, they tracked him down pretty quickly. It was only a couple of days.
Yeah, it's kind of shocking that this is the level that it's gotten to, especially with the capability of the internet, social media, and now, you know, Facebook Live. I mean, these things can be put up on the internet so fast and real time and before anyone can do anything about them.
Well, especially if you remember we covered the bystander syndrome where, you know, people don't help people who are being assaulted. We had a famous case in Chicago from about a year ago of the Marriott bartender just a couple blocks from here who went out and fell off the curb at 7-Eleven and got beaten and ultimately died when a car ran over him because no one helped him. There's surveillance films showing him on the ground, no one helping him. Similarly, it's shocking, and the police superintendent, Eddie Johnson, commented that it's shocking how someone could watch this live stream and not pick up the phone and dial 911.
Yeah, not a lot more to say there. We move on to a Red Bull heir who avoided legal action after he hit a cop, I think, on a motorcycle, and somehow he's not going to go to court for this.
Yeah, the legal news this week or late last week was the statute of limitations has run or will run, actually, or strike that. Let me say it's run. There's a 5-year statute of limitations, and this person, his name is, I'm going to butcher this, but Varayuth Uvida, he's an heir to the Red Bull fortune. The family is worth $10 billion. And in 2012, he was driving an expensive, I think it was a Ferrari, in Bangkok and hit a police officer on a motorcycle, dragged him along the road, and then fled, took off. He was ultimately arrested. And he was released on $15,000 bail, went home. And as I said, the statute of limitations is running against him. This is, you know, an example, of course, of how if you are wealthy, you've got a better opportunity than others to deal with this kind of, you know, crime. This is especially true in Thailand. There's lots of examples in Thailand in the legal system of, as you can imagine, some political corruption and money buying your way through this type of situation.
Yeah,
so,
and this kid keeps missing court dates. His attorneys keep telling the court officials and judges that they can't find him, that he's sick, he's on business trips. And if you read through his social media pages, you can find where this kid's at. He's in London. He's in, you know, all over the world enjoying the luxury lifestyle, spending, you know, sometimes $1,000 a night with his family vacationing. So it is, like Rich said, it's just the way the Thailand legal system's working right now. He's obviously easily and readily available for prosecution, but with that wealth, it's influential in Thailand.
I wonder if he was drinking Red Bull and Tito's when he was driving.
That story does really remind us of the affluenza teen from a few years ago,
exactly,
too, right?
Oh, exactly, yeah. True.
Same sort of thing. All right, former cowboy accused in sexual battery case. So, great news again.
Yeah, Michael Irvin.
the theme of the show just piling away.
Right.
bad people doing bad things. Yep. Michael Irvin, of course, Hall of Famer for the Cowboys, member of the Triplets back in the 90s, along with Troy Aikman and Emmitt Smith. He was named in a sexual battery report. Incident took place in a hotel room in Fort Lauderdale, allegedly, on March 22nd. There was the alleged victim is a 27-year-old Florida woman who said that she met Irvin at the W Hotel in Fort Lauderdale, went back to his room. She said that she started to feel sick. Last thing she remembered was fighting Irvin off. When she woke up, she said that he was checking out of the room, and she took an Uber home. She then called police to say that she feared that she had been drugged and raped. She took a swab and a blood test. Irvin, through his attorney, has categorically denied the allegations and planned to meet up with Fort Lauderdale police shortly to go over things. Not the first time Michael Irvin's been in trouble. Back in his playing days, he was a member of the group of people who allegedly frequented a hostel in Dallas. So legal news involving the ex-Cowboy.
Yeah, there's some text messages too that between Irvin and the sexual assault victim that show she was inviting him to come back. She's a cosmetologist and invited him to come back when he's back in Fort Lauderdale. So those text messages, they create a nice record either for or against, but they definitely preserve that.
I think I said hostel. I meant brothel, by the way. Did I say hostile?
You did say hostile.
Hostile wouldn't be so bad.
Yeah, that doesn't seem illegal
weird
at all.
Michael Irvin was backpacking at a hostel in Dallas. Yeah.
Got in a lot of trouble
fame.
For that.
Yeah.
So then we move on to Chris Brown, who is refusing to leave his girlfriend alone, and I don't know how to say her name. I don't know if I just am not caught up.
Is this a harder name than the Thai bowl?
To me,
Red
it
bowl
is.
Guy?
Karrueche Tran?
Yeah.
All right, sure.
That wasn't so hard.
Right?
Spit that right out, Craig.
All right, good talk.
Yeah, Chris Brown, he's immune from a restraining order, apparently. He's dodged the service of this restraining order, and he just refuses to believe that he has to succumb to the law when it comes to this. It's obviously Karrueche Tran, however Craig said it. His ex-girlfriend had filed a restraining order against him after she claimed that he abused her during the relationship and has been threatening her since he broke up. Seems to be kind of Chris Brown's M.O., so... I don't think there's any doubt with the truth of that, but he keeps dodging the service of the restraining order. So Trans Firm has reportedly hired a private company to find and serve Brown the legal papers, which, again, with social media, I'm sure is not going to be too difficult to track him down.
Yeah, she claims that he struck her twice and threw her down a flight of stairs and threatened to kill her. I mean, how is Chris Brown still around making music? How do people still support this
or guy? Why is anyone in a relationship with Chris Brown? Jennifer Lopez, also in the news. She's facing a lawsuit over hoverboards. I just like that title. So what's why? tell me why.
Yeah, just your typical J-Lo hoverboard legal story.
Yep.
She was given, according to the Sidekick group, she was given 42 custom hoverboards back in 2015 to use during her Planet Hollywood show.
What do you
in
need
Vegas.
42 hoverboards for?
You've apparently never enjoyed the J-Lo show like I have. it's a centerpiece to the entertainment. And she was supposed to promote the company in exchange. She was supposed to give a bunch of shout-outs and tweets on social media. The lawsuit says that she only gave one instead of the multiple she was supposed to. And... they are seeking damages of the value of 42 hoverboards, which is about $54,000. This same company also threatened a lawsuit against Richard Sherman from the Seahawks, saying that he also did not follow his end of the bargain when it comes to promoting the hoverboard. So got to live up to your deal when it comes to hoverboard promotion. You know that.
Yeah, I mean, every time I get hoverboards, I always give a shout out to them. I don't
Absolutely.
Even know how to use one.
Craig, play us out with some Scarface music.
Only if you do the voice a little bit more too.
Well, that was a little fresh off on WGN. Join us every week with
yep.
my co-host Craig and Jason Whiteside.
Wow.
I got
Say
two
hello to my little
partner.
Yeah, that's fantastic.